You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Amazon was once just an online bookseller. Then it became one of the world's largest internet retailers, selling everything from clothes to lawn furniture and diapers. But now it's starting to perform crucial functions that are having an outsized effect on the rest of the U.S. economy. Joining us is Barney Jobson, the retail correspondent for the Financial Times, who's been covering the online behemoth. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our program. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
Now, I said the U.S. economy. Should I have said the global economy?
Increasingly, yes. Amazon is dominant in the U.S. It also has a big presence in 7 or 8 other countries, the U.K., Germany, France, Italy, China and Japan as well. But it's really the U.S. that sets the pace, and I think the U.S. that shows us where Amazon's trying to take the business. Those other countries are still smaller for the time being.
You're right that Amazon is a largely unregulated steward of vital commercial plumbing. How crucial is the company to the U.S. economy and other countries' economies today?
Well, this gets into an important change in Amazon's business. A lot of people still think of it as an online retailer, but what's actually happening is it's turning inside out many of the systems it's built and enabling other companies to use them. And in that sense, it's becoming an infrastructure provider. And what I mean there is that other companies can now sell their products on Amazon's website, they can store their goods in Amazon's warehouses, they can use its computing servers to run their databases, they can even use Amazon's customer service systems. So if you take an extreme case, it's now possible for a retailer to focus on doing nothing but finding the products it wants to sell, and then it plugs itself into Amazon systems, and Amazon does the rest. So it's becoming a very important linchpin of a lot of businesses.
Hasn't it also just created a lot of the machinery of the internet? So it's convenient for others to use it rather than to build their own version?
Yeah, absolutely. One remarkable statistic I've read is that approximately 1% of all consumer traffic now touches Amazon systems. And if you think how much traffic there is, that's quite a big number. To give a few examples, Amazon's cloud computing systems are now used by websites a lot of people will recognize, such as Netflix, the movie streaming service, Spotify, the music streaming service, Dropbox, the file storage service. So it's running as a silent engine, if you like, behind a lot of recognizable businesses.
So those companies are coming to Amazon and saying, we'd rather just use your equipment rather than build our own? And in some cases, aren't they in competition? Like, wasn't Target using Amazon for a while?
That's absolutely right. What they are doing is they're coming to Amazon and saying, can we use your systems? Because it's cheaper that way. If you're creating a startup now, rather than having to buy your own servers, you can use Amazon servers, and it saves you a lot of money. But yes, there are conflict of interest questions here, because Amazon is competing against a lot of these businesses while serving them at the same time.
And also, haven't there been some breakdowns which have caused problems?
Yeah, in the last 18 months, I think we've seen 2 or 3 outages with Amazon Web Services, this cloud computing business, and that's brought down some of those client websites. And this really brings us to one of the systemic risks here. Amazon is becoming the infrastructure provider behind all kind of businesses, but are we comfortable with that level of dependence? Because when so many people are dependent on one company and something goes wrong, the impact of that problem is much greater.
Well, we think of the cloud as something up there in the skies, but actually it's a lot of infrastructure, as you say. Should we be thinking of Amazon to some degree as a utility?
That's a very good way of looking at it. It is increasingly looking like electricity companies and power companies. And one thing we know about those two sectors, of course, is that they have such importance that regulators started to take an interest in them. And then in different ways, those companies are controlled and limited by regulators.
Did this develop by accident? People realizing that Amazon had this, or Amazon realizing it had the ability to do these things?
Well, we've done a big series on the company at the FT, and I've spoken to people who've been at Amazon from the early days, or people who were at Amazon in the early days, and they say that this idea of being a platform on which other people can do business has been around for a long time. And if you think about the company's founder, Jeff Bezos, he started off at a hedge fund. He was working here in New York in the stock market, and the stock market is a very good model for what Amazon's doing. It's creating a space in which other people can do transactions. So I think it has been there from the start, at least in a subdued way.
But a utility would be regulated. Do we see people calling for regulation of Amazon?
No, not at the moment. And I think part of the reason is that there's not a broad recognition of just how big its business is becoming. It's probably extreme to think about Amazon as a fully regulated entity. But what we can expect, I think, is legal challenges to the way it runs this ecosystem it's created. If we think about Microsoft, which is another interesting parallel, it created a platform in the form of its Windows operating system. And that sparked lots of controversies because even though it allowed other companies to come in and develop apps for that system, it also started to muscle in on the juiciest parts of the business itself. So there are questions of fairness, I think, that could bring these legal challenges.
Microsoft was accused of excluding others from using its system, and we've seen Apple accused of something similar. I'm sure Amazon is aware of that as a potential problem for them.
Yeah, I think it probably is, but Amazon's a pretty tight-lipped company. It's not really shared what it's thinking on this. And I think the most compelling example of fairness questions so far is back in the retail space, where Amazon will watch what many of the clients it's supporting are selling. It will spot the hottest products, and it will often start to sell those products itself at a lower price, which means that all of a sudden its clients are struggling to compete against it. And that is a source of consternation that I've picked up in my conversations, and I think that's an issue that Amazon's going to have to manage more clearly and explicitly.
And people are starting to pay attention, not just your publication, but today Time magazine published a story which asked, will Amazon take over the world? Do you think it might? I mean, haven't similar questions been asked about Google, Facebook, and Apple? Is Amazon any different?
What's very different about Amazon is the way it approaches innovation. Google, Facebook, Apple, they're all about using technology to come up with interesting, new, exciting products. Amazon's not about the new. Amazon's about reinventing the old. It's about using technology to do pretty humdrum tasks like managing inventory, running websites, delivering boxes. That's rather less exciting, but it actually has a more profound influence on the way the world operates than those other tech companies.
And you're right. The company has branched out into the realm of network businesses such as stock exchanges, power grid operators, credit card processors, and shipping lines. Is that simply because of the scale of their retail business, or are they investing in these systems?
They're investing huge amounts of money in them. The advantage of doing that and then selling them as services is that it's able to make a profit from those investments. So it makes financial sense. And again, coming back to the stock market analogy, if you're at the center of the stock market helping other people to do transactions and you take a little fee on the way, a nickel here, a dime there, multiply that many times over, you can make a lot of money. And that's exactly what Amazon's doing with this infrastructure. It's taking a small cut of every transaction, but doing that a million times over, it becomes a lot of money.
But also, isn't it making the overall economy more efficient?
That's one of the big advantages, yeah, and that is an undeniable advantage, and that's why so many businesses are choosing to work with Amazon. And let's remember that they're doing this out of choice. Nobody's compelling them to do so, and there are big advantages to be gained, large amounts of money to be saved. But I think Amazon has now reached such a scale that we need to be a little more aware of some of the downsides of working with it as well.
And as we said earlier, some of them are pulling out, like Target, which was with Amazon for a while, but no longer. Did they have to build their own infrastructure as a result?
They did, and it was a project that took a couple of years. And unfortunately for Target, soon after they launched their own website using their own systems, they had a very big sale, very popular, and the rush of customers was such that their system collapsed. So that was a reminder that, you know, Amazon is pretty good at what it does and can help a lot of these clients.
My guest is Barney Jobson, the retail correspondent for Financial Times. We're talking about Amazon, which is no longer just a company that sells books online. Do some people see it as a disruptive business force? I mean, prices can change on Amazon as often as every 15 minutes.
Yeah, this has been one of the defining characteristics, I think, of Amazon over the last 17 years. It's disrupted book selling, it's disrupted the sale of music and all kinds of other products online. And now that disruptive force is arriving in cloud computing. It's even arriving in publishing. Amazon is now a publishing business all of its own, and it's arrived in the warehouse sector. And one of the unifying themes here is what Amazon does. It identifies places where there are inefficiencies, where there are middlemen who are perhaps slowing things down, and then it uses its technology to introduce efficiency, to speed things up, and to do it at a lower price. So it can sometimes seem that Amazon is expanding in a perhaps illogical range of directions. But what tends to unify what it does is using technology to make stuff quicker and more efficient.
The same sort of software that was developed for things like high-frequency trading by banks and hedge funds?
Yeah, that brings us back to the question of prices moving on the websites. And this is a fascinating element of the system. Amazon has been using these algorithms, as they're called, to adjust its prices very rapidly so it can try and stay ahead of its rivals with the lowest prices. And now many of the other companies selling on its website are doing the same thing. So you're seeing competition between these different algorithms, and prices on Amazon are now moving as often as every 15 minutes.
Although, at times, those out-of-control algorithms can cause a problem. You note that the price of a genetics book called The Making of a Fly went up to $23 million for shipping last year. What happened?
That's right. What happened is that a combination of these algorithms started to interact and effectively malfunctioned, and they kept pushing each other to push the price higher, and it went up to $23 million. It was a funny example. I don't think anybody actually lost out from that, because no consumer was going to be tricked into buying it for that price. And no seller was going to gain that big profit either. If it goes in the other direction and prices get pushed down, that can be a problem. Again,
has that happened? We suddenly see a book selling for 10 cents when they wanted to sell for $20?
Yep, I've heard of cases of that happening. And hey, that's good for consumers. If you spot that opportunity and you grab it in time, good for you. It's very bad for the seller, because they're probably going to make a big loss on that sale.
Well, it sounds similar to the 2010 flash crash on the New York Stock Exchange.
Exactly. That flash crash involved algorithms again interacting in a way that hadn't been expected and pushing the prices of a series of stocks down to near $1 in a very short space of time, and they then bounced back up again. So the more you rely on these kind of algorithms, the more, again, systemic risk there is in the system, and the more I think we need to be aware of the possible dangers.
Well, I guess the only problem for the customer is if you think you're going to be spending a certain amount of money and discover it's a lot higher, you either assume that Amazon is overcharging or that something's gone wrong with the algorithm.
Yeah, it means customers, I think, have to be a lot more diligent, if you like. And this is one of the interesting things, I think, about the evolution of online shopping. People talk about the customer being in charge now because there's so much information out there, everything's so transparent. I think that's true if the customer has unlimited time to stay on top of things, but we're all busy human beings, and I think it can actually be quite overwhelming to try and make sure that you have done all the research you should do, because things are changing so quickly you can't keep up.
A Harvard business professor warned about the risk if the website were to have some disaster and shut down, calling it a source of systemic risk that we didn't have before. What kinds of consequences for the rest of the economy would there be if Amazon just stopped working one day?
Well, if we come back to the example of the cloud computing business and those services like Spotify and Dropbox I mentioned, websites, that were using those services were brought to a halt for a few hours when its web systems came down. So that's a very damaging example for those businesses. And if we think about the warehousing and the retailing operations, if Amazon has some kind of catastrophic failure, then there'll be all kinds of businesses that can't sell anything.
Well, what it would mean for Spotify or Netflix is that they couldn't stream their content for a little while. But big deal.
Well, it's a big deal for those companies and for their investors, because when they can't stream content, they can't make money. And another example of a company that had used Amazon is Zynga, which is an online gaming service. They previously, I think, had 80 or 90% of their systems running on Amazon's web services, but last year they decided they were going to switch that. They said it was because their own in-house services were going to be slightly more appropriate to their needs. But I'm sure that there was also an awareness that being dependent on Amazon did create these risks.
And now it's being reported that the company is making a push for same-day delivery. Well, how would that work? The whole idea of Amazon in the past was that it didn't have to maintain warehouses, it cut down on a lot of expense. They could order as required. Well, you can't do that with same-day delivery.
This is a fascinating example of how the company has not given up on retail and its own retail business. I think it's realized that whereas it's won a lot of sales from bricks and mortar retailers in the last 17 years, bricks and mortar retailers still have an advantage. One of many advantages, one of them is immediacy. If you perhaps need to buy some toothpaste this evening, then it doesn't make any sense to order it from Amazon if it's not going to arrive for 2 or 3 days. You'll go to the drugstore and pick it up on your way home. However, If Amazon can build a warehouse on the other side of the Hudson River, let's say in New Jersey, and get that toothpaste delivered to you in 2 or 3 hours, then you don't need to go to the drugstore anymore. So by bringing its warehouses closer to big population centres, it can speed up delivery, offer same-day delivery, and that erodes one of the final reasons why we would need to go to a bricks-and-mortar store.
And they would do that out of all the major urban centres?
It's already happening. It's happening in Jersey. They've struck deals in Texas to build new warehouses. They're planning warehouses in California. And the root of this was that for a long time, Amazon didn't collect sales tax from consumers in many states. And in order to avoid collecting sales tax, it could not have a physical presence in these states. But now it's realized that the sales tax is going to become inevitable, and that frees it up to have a physical presence in as many places as it wants in this country. So that's why we're seeing a new drive for more warehouses.
But they also can build the warehouses in states that have lower taxes.
They could, but I think there's probably a psychological point for consumers that the difference between paying no tax and paying any tax is much more substantial in the consumer mind than paying no tax and perhaps the 3% rate it might be in some states.
Barney Jobson is the retail correspondent for Financial Times. We're talking about Amazon, which he and a team have been following for a series of stories. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, filmmaker Lauren Greenfield talks about her documentary, The Queen of Versailles, about a couple that was building the largest home in America. And then at 1, find out what it's like to command an explosive ordnance disposal unit in Iraq and then try to return to normal life back home. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC is supported by Dutton, publisher of Night Watch by Linda Fairstein. Former District Attorney Fairstein combines a modern-day plot with the history of New York City restaurants in her latest Alexandra Cooper novel, now available wherever books are sold. Silver Hill Hospital, specializing in the treatment of psychiatric and addictive disorders in adolescents and adults, providing acute inpatient care and residential programs, online at silverhillhospital.org. The Joyce Theater, presenting Palabolas, now through August 11th, featuring 3 New York premieres and highlights from the company's repertory. Tickets at joyce.org.
One of the best parts of being retired is I get to be a WNYC junkie. Are you kidding?
WNYC Listener's Legacy Circle member, Janet Mardfin.
WNYC is a community, and I'm part of it. And being a Legacy Circle member, it's a way of leaving a mark on New York City, which is my home.
Find out how to name WNYC in your estate plan. Call 646-829-4587 or email legacygiving@WNYC.org.
Barney Jobson is my guest. He is the retail correspondent for the Financial Times, that wonderful business publication. And obviously you'd be following Amazon as a retail business. Should we think of it now as a tech company?
Amazon itself always talks about itself as a tech company. And as the retail business becomes a relatively smaller part of the company, there are many more reasons to think about it as a technology company, as I say, in the same group as Apple, Google, and Facebook.
More than Walmart.
Yeah. Now, Amazon has been influenced by Walmart in some ways. It's very much adopted Walmart's low-cost mentality, the idea of frugality, the idea of devoting yourself to squeezing costs out of the system so you can pass those low prices on to customers. So in a way, it's combined that Walmart penny-pinching way with the kind of technological wizardry of Facebook and Google and Apple.
But you've been suggesting that there are many other entities that sell things through Amazon. Are we talking about something like eBay or something much grander?
It is like eBay. eBay also provides a platform for other businesses. But what often happens with these platform businesses is that one of the players will reach a critical mass and then everybody will gravitate towards it because it makes so much sense, because there's so much else going on there. And I think Amazon is perhaps approaching that critical mass where it's very difficult to avoid being there if you want to have a substantial presence online, because it offers you access to 85 million customers. So this snowball effect, I think, is already in action.
Well, what kind of information does Amazon collect on its third-party sellers?
The most important thing is that it can see what are the most popular products on their site. It can also see what's in their inventory, and it can use that information to its advantage. So I spoke to a vacuum seller from Northern Virginia. Now, when they built their presence on Amazon, Amazon wasn't even in the vacuum business. But in the last few years, Amazon's entered the vacuum business, and they told me that in many cases that they've seen a very popular product flying out of their warehouses, and then lo and behold, a short while later, Amazon will start to sell it itself at a lower price, and they can't compete. So there's a potential conflict of interest there, which I don't think has been approached head-on yet.
A real warning to a company that wants to sell through Amazon, but maybe have no choice. Diane Buzzio, the founder of Ability Commerce, told you it's amazing they haven't been hit with some kind of a non-competition lawsuit. Do you think that's going to happen?
It brings us back to the broader question of fairness. And
But I'm wondering whether the law has caught up with the advances in technology that keep on changing day after day.
Generally, the law is a laggard. The law does not catch up with technology. Technology, by its nature, is ahead of the rest of us. And I think as these platform businesses, these infrastructure businesses take on more importance, there are going to be legal challenges to the way they operate, about market abuse, about the fairness of pricing. So I would not be surprised if in the years to come we do see challenges to the way Amazon operates this system. Just to come back to eBay, one important difference is that whereas eBay allows other people to sell on its site, it does not sell its own products. So eBay is not competing with its clients in the way Amazon is.
One investment banker told you that Amazon's position today is reminiscent of Goldman Sachs' dual role as a broker and trader at the center of capital markets. Is that meant as a compliment or a criticism?
I certainly don't think it's a compliment. Now, one of the keys to Goldman Sachs' success is that they are in the center of the flow. This is the phrase people use. They're in the center of the flow of information and trades in the market. So they have a privileged view of everything that's happening, and they can use that privileged view to make their own trading decisions. And this is exactly what we see Amazon doing. They're in the center of the flow. They can see everything, and therefore they can make smarter choices than everyone else. But Goldman Sachs, by virtue of that role, has sparked all kinds of controversies about conflicts of interest. So, yes, I think that is the model to which Amazon is heading.
Well, a listener asks, what do you think retail will look like in 5 years if Amazon continues on its current trajectory?
I think we're going to see fewer bricks and mortar stores. We'll see established chains closing stores. We'll see more individual operators closing. But I don't think it's all over for bricks and mortar. I think there are reasons why people still like to shop in the real world. One is that you can browse in a store, of course. You can discover stuff that's interesting that you'd never thought of finding, and it's very difficult to browse on the internet.
They try to do that. They tell you, here are some other books you might be interested in, but it's not the same thing as walking through a store and seeing a book you just never even imagined had been written and picking it up and thinking, gee, I really want that.
No. Amazon is pretty good at data mining, but it's still not been able to replicate the browsing experience in the store. Another reason to go to a store is the tactile nature of shopping. There are plenty of products, clothes in particular, that people want to touch and feel and try on, and nobody's found a way to really replicate that online. And also, shopping in the real world is a social experience. It's nice to get out of the house and mingle with other people. So for all those reasons, I don't think it's over for bricks and mortar stores, but I think they do need to focus more on making shopping a more fun and enjoyable experience.
Well, Ann Patchett, the writer who also owns a bookstore in Nashville, has said, "This should be a place for all of us, but Amazon aggressively wants to kill us."
Now, it's difficult to read Amazon's mind, but what I have heard from people who know the company is that Amazon is not interested in destroying anyone. They say that they're all about taking the technology and extending it as far as it can go. Now, that's all well and good, but there's a question of whether they can absolve themselves of responsibility for the side effects of that, even if they say that it's not their primary ambition to put other people out of business.
My guest is Barney Jobson, the retail correspondent for the Financial Times. We're talking about Amazon, which has grown into a company no one could have imagined it would become. I'm sure not even the Amazon people when they started. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You note that Amazon is revolutionizing the way entrepreneurs can create startups. How is it doing that?
By turning those systems inside out and enabling people to build businesses at much lower costs than they would have done previously. Now, in the old days, if you wanted to set up a business selling something, you would have had to buy your own server space, you would have had to set up your own website, you would have had to buy your own storage space, you would have had to have your own customer service people. But now Amazon is enabling you to outsource all those functions to itself, and you can just focus on finding products. And this is a fascinating move, because for the retail purist, retail is all about choosing the merchandise. So now you can focus on doing that on your own, let Amazon do the rest. But there are downsides, the prime one being that you're giving away a lot of your independence to Amazon.
And you might even be giving them ideas about what they might want to sell, like
that
vacuum
too.
Cleaners.
Yeah.
You're right that, in effect, Amazon is unbundling the corporation.
This is a concept that emerged in the late 1990s, and the idea was that traditionally in business we've thought about all kind of functions that need to be integrated together in one entity, the customer service, the marketing, the logistics, the distribution, all that. And in the late
hybrid businesses?
Yes, but now Amazon is allowing you to unbundle all those services and create a hybrid business in which you and your ideas are combined with its systems. When this idea emerged, unbundling in the late 1990s, the technology didn't really make it possible. But what's happening now, 10, 15 years later, is you can unbundle.
Amazon started as a bookseller, then branched into e-books. Hasn't it had a tremendous relationship, or a tenuous relationship, with the publishing industry?
There is a huge amount of hostility directed towards Amazon from both booksellers and the publishing industry.
But the publishers have no choice. It's where they sell a lot of their books.
Absolutely. There's this ambivalent relationship. They need Amazon to sell books, but now Amazon itself is getting into the publishing business. It's a threat to them. And publishing is a famously kind of erudite yet slightly amateurish industry full of all the kind of efficiencies which Amazon thinks it can use its technology to eliminate. So yes, they need Amazon to sell their books, but now Amazon is trying to steal their lunch.
Well, what about getting into the book business? What does that mean? Are they really getting good writers?
Yep, they've signed up a few big name authors, Tim Ferriss and Deepak Chopra. They've signed up the North America rights for the James Bond books. So they are making a serious move to sign up these big name authors. And they're also allowing, let's say, unprofessional, non-professional authors to publish books on their own through a system called Kindle Direct Publishing, which enables you to publish your own book as an ebook with a few clicks of the mouse. And a remarkable number is that last month Amazon said that 22 of the top-selling books in its Kindle store, in its ebook store, were self-published titles.
Wow, so and it makes it a lot less expensive to self-publish.
Yeah.
And than having to go out and buy paper and have the thing typeset and design a cover and everything.
And it's also a lot quicker, you know, with the established publishing industry. It can often be a wait of 6 months or 1 year between submitting your manuscript and getting the book published. Now you can do it almost instantly.
Well, 1 in 5 Americans now uses an e-reader. Most of them are Kindles, Amazon's product. How much more growth is anticipated in the e-reader market?
Well, I don't want to say it's endless. I don't think it is. There are still plenty of people who enjoy the feel of a printed book. But the growth that we've seen so far has surprised a lot of people. And I think that can continue. But it's also worth remembering that, again, in the world of technology, we never know what's around the corner. We never know what new technology is going to change the way we read. So the Kindle is kind of predominant now, but in 5-10 years' time, there could be whole new technologies that enable us to read.
Well, others have come along with competitive products, but Kindle wasn't the first. Sony, I think, had an earlier product. Why has Kindle pretty much dominated the market?
I think it's two things. It's low cost. Again, Amazon has been very successful in driving down the cost of this product. And the second thing is that Amazon has a bigger book library than anyone else. So if you want to have access to the broadest possible selection of books, then it's got to be the Kindle because they've got the biggest library.
Well, when you buy a book on Amazon, isn't it only readable on a Kindle? So isn't there a question as to whether you really own it? If you want to move to a different e-reader, would you have to buy the book all over again?
Yeah, you would. This is a question of transferability, and this is an area where some customers feel they're not getting a great deal, because the more you buy on Kindle, the more you're locked into the Kindle system. And this reminds me of a conversation I had when I was in Seattle, Amazon's hometown, with somebody in a secondhand bookstore, and we were talking about the limits of technology, and he said, "Hey, I've got a 400-year-old book, and it still works. Can you show me a Kindle I'm going to be able to use in 400 years' time?"
Why has Amazon been able to corner e-reading but not online music distribution, which is largely controlled by Apple? They did release a cloud player along with a special promotion which allowed people to buy an entire Lady Gaga album for 99 cents, but then it failed to catch on.
Amazon had a head start in books. It did not have that head start in music, and Apple is a formidable competitor. And Apple remains way ahead of Amazon in terms of market share. And I think, again, what we see there is this this idea that the winner takes all in these platform businesses. Apple is so dominant in music that if you're going to sign up for a new music service yourself, well, it makes sense to go with Apple because they've got all the songs. And the more songs you buy from Apple, the more sense it makes to stay with Apple.
When I shop on Amazon, how much data is it collecting on me?
We don't know, but it's quite striking to think that some people have been shopping on Amazon for, 16, 17 years now. So they've got nearly two decades of information about what you've bought at minimum. And whereas Google and Facebook have faced all kinds of controversies over privacy issues relating to data, Amazon never has, but I think we can be pretty confident that they know more about what we buy than anyone else.
It has a dominant CEO, Jeff Bezos. Is being dependent on one man for vision, like Steve Jobs was at Apple, is that a problem for a company like this?
It's an issue that certainly makes investors uncomfortable, and Amazon doesn't even have an identifiable or an obvious number two. So Bezos is a very smart man, and he's largely responsible for a lot of the smart strategic decisions the company's made. But it's true, the lack of an obvious deputy unnerves some people in the markets.
Well, Shel Kaffan, a former Amazon employee, called the atmosphere inside the company brutal and Darwinian. What did he mean by that?
What he was saying is that in Amazon, it's very much a sink or swim atmosphere. Certainly in headquarters, he said that your bosses aren't there to look out for you, that you've got to kind of look after yourself, and no one's interested in making life comfortable for you. You've really got to fight for yourself. Somebody else told me that's a very striking thing about Amazon meetings, that if you go to a meeting and you're not prepared, you can't fight for your idea, you can't back it up with numbers, you will get torn to pieces, metaphorically, by your colleagues.
And you note that Jeff Bezos has looked to Toyota for inspiration. Toyota works that way?
Yeah, I mentioned the lessons Amazon's taken from Walmart. Toyota's another one. Now, the Toyota atmosphere is not so much about these no-holds-barred interrogations of your colleagues. It's much more about industrial processes. It's about reducing defects. It's about reducing waste. It's about reducing costs. It's about making sure that you can do things, moving boxes around a warehouse, for example, as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Although Lisa in Forest Hills has written us, is Amazon doing anything to try to minimize the boxes they use? I love it. Buy many things from them, but they waste lots of boxes and shipping material.
It's a very good question. The answer is yes, and it's another example of this technology. Amazon has developed an algorithm, again coming back to these mathematical computing equations, an algorithm that tells it what is the smallest size of box it can use to ship whatever combination of products you've bought. So if you buy a bottle of shampoo, a book, a cuddly toy, you can feed those three products into its computers, and it will tell you, okay, here is the smallest box size you can use. So that minimizes the waste. But it's true that the sheer number of boxes being sent out around the country is creating a new source of waste or recycling material, depending on how it's used.
A couple of listeners have pointed out that if you buy a book for the Kindle, you can read it on your iPad or iPhone using the Kindle app. So there is some crossover.
That's right. There's some crossover. You can read it within the Amazon system, but you can't switch it to the Sony or the Apple ecosystem, even though you can read it on an Apple device.
And just one more thing. One of our shows that we produce on the station, On the Media, just did a segment about Kindle's aggregating information. I mean, Amazon aggregating information through Kindle this weekend. How do they analyze you?
That I'm not sure of. And again, Amazon's a pretty tight-lipped company. They don't share that with us. But I think as the world appreciates their growing influence, there's going to be more pressure on Amazon to tell us about exactly what they're doing with that information.
And now the Times is writing about how the iPhone is can tell people where we move every moment of our lives. You got to buy disposable cell phones if you don't want people to know where you are all the time. It's getting kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how do you disguise what you're buying? I mean, if you don't use a credit card and you don't use a cell phone anymore, then suddenly your shopping options become quite limited.
Barney Jobson is the retail correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you. Pleasure.